welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from The Atlantic, from The Washington Post, from Religion News Service, and more. This broadcast is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and don't forget that podcasts of Religion in the News episodes are available on our website at ncreadingservice.org. We'll begin this week on Religion in the News with an article that I had intended to feature last week, and the program ran too long, and so I wasn't able to squeeze it in, so we'll lead off with it this week. And this article is from the November edition of The Atlantic magazine, and it's entitled The Evangelical Reckoning Begins. Subheadline, Andy Stanley, the pastor of one of the largest megachurches in the country, ponders the future of an influential corner of American Christianity. And this is by Emma Green of The Atlantic. Andy Stanley's evangelical megachurch was empty on election night, with only a few cars in the Disney World-style parking lot out front. North Point Community Church and its nine satellites in the Atlanta area have been mostly closed since the coronavirus pandemic began in March. When Stanley decided to cancel in-person worship until at least early 2021, dozens of families were so unhappy that they decided to quit his church. "Never once did I hear, 'We're upset because we miss coming to church,'" he told me, leaning back in a heather gray wingback chair. The vibe of his church offices is tasteful and inoffensive, as if his decorator was trying to channel that magic fixer-upper quality of looking distinctive while appealing to almost everyone. "What I heard was, 'We're upset because you bought into a political agenda. We're upset because you believe the Democrats' narrative.'" Stanley has spent his career in ministry deliberately avoiding this kind of politicization in his church. The 62-year-old pastor is a child of the religious right. His father, Charles Stanley, is a televangelist and former president of the Southern Baptist Convention, who wrote the devotional that President George W. Bush used to read each morning. "I grew up in a family that was very, very right-leaning," Stanley said. "I saw the hypocrisy there." He yearned to reach people beyond the conservative Christian world, to make the story of the resurrection irresistible to the unchurched. So he rejected his culture war inheritance and struck out on his own, and now the son has arguably surpassed the father. Andy Stanley leads a congregation of more than 37,000 adults and children each Sunday, second in size in the U.S. only to Joel Osteen's Houston Empire, according to some estimates. He's written roughly two dozen books, mostly Jesus-y self-help, including one that came out in October called Better Decisions, Fewer Regrets. North Point has a network of about 90 churches around the world, and young Christian leaders flock to the church for guidance on how to expand their influence. Sam Collier, a black pastor and friend of Stanley's who is about to open Atlanta's first branch of Hillsong, the Australian mega-ministry network, told me North Point is like the Christian Gap. The rise of Donald Trump, however, has made it harder than ever to separate evangelicalism from politics. Exit polls suggest that three-quarters of white, self-described evangelicals who voted chose Trump in 2020, a slightly smaller share than in 2016, but still an overwhelming majority. To his credit, he's figured out how to leverage that group, Stanley said. "I mean, he's not evangelical, but he owns them, and they've loved him." The pastor likened the relationship to a lyric from Bob Seger's Night Moves. "I used her, she used me, but neither one cared." "Soon Trump will be gone," he said, "but the conservative judges and justices he appointed will be in place for a long time. It's like, got what we wanted." Stanley declined to join his friends in ministry on the Trump train, waving them off when they texted selfies from Trump Tower. But neither has he joined the evangelical resistance, remaining notably quiet at times when other prominent conservative Christian leaders have spoken out, including after the deadly 2017 white supremacist rally in Charlottesville and on the issue of family separation. He maintains that he doesn't want to be a headline news preacher and comments selectively on current events. This summer, he crafted a message focused on the killing of George Floyd. "It's not that I don't have opinions. It's more that people don't come to church to hear my opinions." But while Stanley and similar giants inside the evangelical world have largely stayed out of politics during the Trump years, other evangelicals have been busy telling the outside world that their faith is completely aligned with Trumpism. This has created a dilemma. Stanley and his allies are now saddled with an image of evangelicalism they don't want and didn't create. Before they can reach anyone with a message of faith over politics, they'll have to contend with the political baggage their fellow Christian leaders created. In the Gospels, Jesus calls on his followers to go out, teach his message, and baptize people. Stanley has organized his life around this imperative called the Great Commission. The question for evangelicals now is whether the undeniable association between Trump and their version of Christianity will make that work harder. Has this group of people who have somehow become evangelical leaders aligned with Trump hurt the church's ability to reach people outside the church? Absolutely, Stanley said. But he's not overly worried. A year or two from now, he said, all that goes away. New leaders will rise up. The Trump era of evangelical history will fade. Stanley chuckled. And this will just be, for a lot of people, a bad dream. Not everyone believes that recovering from the Trump era will be so simple for the church, however. We Christians have a lot of ground to make up now against those evangelical Trump followers whose devotion to him bordered on the idolatrous, Mark Galley, the former editor-in-chief of Christianity Today, told me. The word evangelical itself may have lost its usefulness. The media's political fascination with evangelicals began in the 1970s, as Jimmy Carter declared himself born again. It continued through the 80s as the religious right consolidated its power under Ronald Reagan. The 90s continued with coverage of greedy televangelists felled by sex scandals, followed by an evangelical resurgence in the 2000s as faith voters helped carry George W. Bush to the White House. The Trump era's evangelical icons have made dramatic contributions to this pocketbook history. Jerry Falwell Jr., the former head of Liberty University and one of Trump's earliest supporters, was recently ousted after posting a picture of himself on a yacht with his pants partially unzipped, followed by evidence of a messy, years-long affair involving his wife and a 20-something Fontainebleau pool attendant. In the past week or so, videos have made the rounds on Twitter of Trump's spiritual advisor, Paula White, praying for angels from Africa to come to America and carry the president to re-election, along with that of another charismatic Trump advisor, Kenneth Copeland, laughing at the media for reporting that Joe Biden had won the presidency. At least on Fox News and at Trump rallies, these figures have been granted the authority to speak for the whole of the evangelical world. And yet their version of Christianity reflects only one corner of the wildly diverse expanse of evangelicalism, which includes roughly one quarter of the American population. Trump's advisors are not evangelical leaders. They're evangelicals who have had their status elevated because they hang around and get invited to the White House, Stanley said. Those people were virtually in the marketplace, unknown until all this happened. It's not that Stanley isn't the kind of evangelical Trump would want by his side. The pastor just didn't want any part of it. Hang around the White House for too long, and the next thing you know, you think you're somebody, he said. I just don't have any business getting sucked into that. Many of Trump's most visible backers are Pentecostal Christians who promise their followers health and wealth in exchange for faithfulness and donations. Pastors like Stanley, a fast-talking skinny jeans fan obsessed with defeating cerebral arguments against Christianity made by new atheist types, have a vested interest in distinguishing their theology from that of charismatic pastors like White. They just make stuff up, Stanley said. This isn't the New Testament. This isn't Christianity. This is just positive thinking. He dismissed comparisons between Trump and Cyrus the Great, the 6th-century Persian king who liberated exiled Hebrews, as silly, along with claims such as the one Eric Trump made before the election, that Trump literally saved Christianity. It's so unfortunate that all evangelicals get lumped in with the evangelicals that have been mainstreamed or platformed around Donald Trump, Stanley said. But Stanley also didn't try to claim, as some have, that real evangelicals don't support Trump. He wouldn't say who he voted for in the past two elections, but he volunteered that he's a conservative guy with conservative values. His wife Sandra watches The Five on Fox News, and their family flips back and forth between the various cable networks. He's never met the president, but after he told a friend that his foster daughter is a diehard Trump fan, he received a personalized video from Trump telling her to do her homework. North Point's original campus in Alpharetta largely leans Republican, he said. He understands Trump's appeal. What he seems to take issue with is the mindset that evangelicals should be all in for Trump because of their faith. It's disappointing, he said. It does not reflect anything in the New Testament. Zero. Christians should put their faith filter in front of their political filter, he told me, putting one hand in front of the other before his mouth to demonstrate. We dare not allow politics to define us as individuals if you're a Jesus follower, he said, but that's hard to keep straight for all of us, I guess. Stanley has a theory about why evangelicals were so eager to back Trump, both in 2016 and 2020. Most evangelical traditions teach that Jesus is going to come back, judge people, and everyone who doesn't follow him to hell. Unfortunately, he said, there's a group of evangelicals that are so excited about that, he slapped his hands together and rubbed them eagerly, waggling his eyebrows for effect, they can't wait. As evangelicals get older and realize that Jesus is likely not going to return to their lifetimes, they get a little bit desperate, he said, wanting to use policy and legislation to bring the world closer to the time of Jesus' return. That kind of thinking makes you vulnerable when somebody comes along and says, by golly, all of your dreams are going to come true. This armchair psychologizing may or may not hold up. What's notable is that a guy as cautious as Stanley is willing to talk about it. Perhaps he believes that a little rewriting of history will help with the headwinds the Trump era has created for those who care about spreading Jesus' message beyond the church. Pastor's willingness to publicly align with the Republican Party pulls the curtain down on the group that you're convinced is the furthest from God, Stanley says. It's anti-everything they got into ministry for. If you're going to pull down the curtain, you should be on the dark side, right? You should be living among them if you're trying to reach these people. In Stanley's view, the biggest way in which Trump has damaged the reputation of the church is in his penchant for name-calling and belittling people, mocking a reporter who has a disability during a campaign rally, for example, or calling people from Mexico criminals and rapists. He believes that the president's attacks on journalists were a terrible move. The first thing totalitarian leaders or governments do is they silence the media, he said. When high-profile evangelical leaders publicly align themselves with Trump, the perception is unavoidable that they believe that kind of rhetoric is okay, especially among the young people Stanley cares most about reaching. Trump's language should undermine his credibility with Christians. It certainly undermined his credibility with the generation that again has low to no tolerance for any of that, he said. And yet Stanley is still unwilling to assign blame to Trump for all of America's problems. If you're asking me, did Donald Trump inflame or make worse or stir up racial tension, I don't know the answer to that, he said. I don't know that I would place that on the shoulders of Donald Trump. Many black Christians have expressed pain over Trump's racism, but Stanley wants to tread carefully. I'm always hesitant to assign or accept simple, broad-brush explanations for anything, especially events I have no personal involvement in or firsthand knowledge of. He firmly supports the sentiment Black Lives Matter, but like a number of other prominent pastors, he says he's uncomfortable with the organization behind the slogan. In a time of such intense political anger, putting faith before politics seems to involve grasping uncertainly at the line between speaking prophetically and making everybody mad. While some pastors around the country spent the days leading up to the election praying for Trump to win, Stanley scored his biggest victory of the election season before the returns had even started coming in, joining Oprah for a primetime special on faith and politics. I assure you, I am the most conservative person on that list of people who she had, he said, but I got invited, so they weren't afraid of me. Meanwhile, others in the evangelical world have been leaning into political division. A couple hours north of Atlanta on I-75, a black billboard near Dalton, Georgia, declares that every tongue will confess Jesus as Lord, even the Democrats, a red pitchfork at the end serving as an exclamation point. The secular world may believe evangelicals are nothing more than people who love Trump. Stanley happily uses the term Jesus follower instead. People within the church, especially those who are black or part of other minority groups, may be grieved over the way their brothers and sisters embraced Trumpism. Stanley has faith that they'll stay in the fold. This isn't going to have long-term adverse effects on the church, I'll say that, he told me. When I asked him why he was so confident, he pulled the ultimate pastor move, eschewing the earthly concerns of today for a heavenly long view. Once upon a time, a handful of disenfranchised Jews crushed between an empire and a temple maintained their faith in a resurrected Savior and changed the world, he said, leaning back in his chair again. So, we're good to go. Our next article on religion in the news this week comes from the Washington Post, November 13th edition, and the article is entitled, Meet the Faith Leaders President-elect Biden is Likely to Consult. This is by Jack Jenkins and Emily McFarland Miller of Religion News Service, although this was published in the Washington Post. Since 2000, when George W. Bush established a permanent liaison in the White House for outreach and coordination with religious groups, no administration has gone without a faith-based advisor. For Bush and Barack Obama, the advisor's role was to coordinate with faith organizations on efforts to alleviate poverty and on other social services, such as settling refugees. President Trump's White House tweaked that a bit, not appointing an official faith advisor until late in his term, and relying mostly on an informal circle of evangelical advisors who pushed a conservative Christian agenda of justice reform, narrowing access to abortion at home, and expanding religious freedom abroad. Compared with Trump, President-elect Joe Biden is likely to bring a more formal and interfaith approach to religious engagement, closer to the model forged by Bush and Obama. Various religious leaders will probably rotate on and off of a fixed advisory council underneath the White House Faith Office that would host public meetings and produce formal reports. But Biden has always shown a penchant for listening to trusted friends and experts he has met in his long career in politics. Look for him to listen to key voices, some of whom may disagree with him on many issues, from his own Catholic community, from Judaism, and yes, evangelicals, but different from those who counseled Trump. Here are a number of faith leaders Biden is likely to consult. Simone Campbell. Biden talked on the campaign trail about the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary back in Scranton, who instilled in him his working-class Catholic ethic. But arguably the most influential nun since his Scranton days has been Simone Campbell, the founder of NTWRC, a social justice lobbying organization that created the Nuns on the Bus tours in 2012 to protest proposed Republican budget cuts and social services spending. Campbell and Biden have had close ties since they met in 2010 at the signing ceremony for the Affordable Care Act, which Campbell had supported. Biden posed with Campbell on the 2014 Nuns on the Bus tour, and the following year invited her to a gathering of Catholics he hosted at his home. Campbell's recent announcement that she would be stepping down as head of NTWRC, effective in March, could free her up to step into a faith-based advisory role, informal or otherwise, at the White House. Joel Hunter. White evangelical Christians are considered Republican loyalists, but if any of them will have Biden's ear, it will be this former Orlando megachurch pastor. Hunter helped launch pro-life evangelicals for Biden this year and was a faith advisor to Obama. He supported the LGBTQ community after the 2016 Pulse nightclub shooting in his home city and has urged evangelicals to join other faith traditions on issues such as the environment, which he referred to as creation care. Hunter, 72, a longtime Republican until he registered as an independent in 2010, led Northland Church in Longwood, Florida for more than 30 years. That puts him in a good position to be an ambassador to more conservative evangelicals to heal divisions and make headway on issues such as human trafficking and prison reform. Michael Beals. 14 years ago, Biden attended a prayer service at Congregation Beth Shalom in Wilmington, Delaware, to honor an elderly donor to his Senate campaigns. He has remained close ever since with Beth Shalom's rabbi, Michael Beals, whom he met that day and who is now often called Biden's rabbi. Beals visited the White House during Biden's tenure as vice president and represented the Jewish community at the funeral for Biden's son, Beau. Beals would be the first to acknowledge that he has never been called upon to offer spiritual advice, much less direction, on navigating American Jewish politics. Advisors to Biden say that for official matters, Biden might turn to Rabbi Julie Schonfeld, former chief executive of the conservative movement's Rabbinical Assembly, or to Rabbi Sharon Brous, the leader of ICAR, a prominent Los Angeles congregation. Tracy Blackman. The Reverend Tracy Blackman, senior pastor of Christ the King United Church of Christ in Florissant, Missouri, first burst onto the national scene while participating in the 2014 demonstrations in Ferguson and went on to serve on Obama's Faith Advisory Council. In the Trump era, she has been a significant voice on racial justice and has become a prominent religious figure in racial justice movements such as Black Lives Matter. She counter-protested at the white supremacist march in Charlottesville in 2017, an event Biden singled out as part of his reason for launching his presidential bid. Blackman, who also serves as Associate General Minister of Justice and Local Church Ministries for the United Church of Christ, praised Biden's decision to choose Senator Kamala D. Harris, Democrat of California, as his running mate, telling the St. Louis American, "It is unprecedented because the strongest, most consistent voting bloc of the Democratic Party, black women, have finally earned the right of representation on the party ticket." Farouk Mitha. A founding board member of the Muslim advocacy group Engage, Mitha, a member of the small but increasingly politically active community of Ismaili Muslims, served as the National Muslim Outreach Director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign before being named as Biden's senior advisor on Muslim-American engagement this year. He's also an alumnus of the Obama administration and advised Biden as the Democratic nominee during the primary this year. Biden also made overtures to bring more Muslim Americans into his coalition. William J. Barber II and Liz Theo Harris. As co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign, the Reverend William J. Barber II and the Reverend Liz Theo Harris espouse strongly liberal policy proposals and have expressed a willingness to mobilize demonstrations against any politician or administration they see as not doing enough to care for the poor. Nonetheless, Barber is no stranger to Democratic politics. He has now spoken at two national Democratic gatherings in 2016 and again in 2019, and he endorsed Biden. Biden, for his part, spoke at a Poor People's Campaign event in September, where he lauded Barber and declared, "I want to be part of your movement." With their devoted following among liberals, Theo Harris and Barber will likely keep their outsider label while representing the progressive faith movement. Josh Dixon. The Biden-Harris campaign's National Faith Engagement Director grew up in a Rochester, New York evangelical church and is the person most likely to head a faith-based programs office in the Biden White House. Josh Dixon understands evangelicals' issues, but as an ally of progressives, he told Religion News Service earlier this year that the key religious issue of the election is systemic racism, could be a broker to the more radical social justice left. Doug Padgett and Brian McLaren. Christian author and activist Brian McLaren and his frequent collaborator, Minnesota pastor Doug Padgett, have won over many progressive evangelicals with their questioning of conservative Christianity's theology and cultural premises. While neither were fixtures of the Obama-era White House advisory faith councils, both have turned overtly political in the age of Trump. Padgett now runs Vote Common Good, a group that has actively campaigned against Trump and helped train Democrats to better articulate a faith message. McLaren, meanwhile, has appeared at many VCG events and added his voice to trainings. Jennifer Butler. As head of the advocacy group Faith in Public Life, the Reverend Jennifer Butler has spent years mobilizing religious groups to assist liberal causes. Her group, which is well known in Washington circles, played a role in the passage of the Affordable Care Act and was among many faith-based organizations that helped organize near-constant demonstrations against Trump. She has also advised previous presidents. She once chaired Obama's Advisory Council on Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. Gabrielle Saguero. Another faith leader who served on Obama's advisory councils, the Reverend Gabrielle Saguero is the founder of the National Latino Evangelical Coalition. He has long been in conversation with Democrats. He prayed this year at the Democratic National Convention, but has insisted the party has not done enough to engage his fellow Hispanic evangelicals, a fast-growing constituency. He recently suggested to Religion News Service that Biden's relatively poor showing in Florida was partly a consequence of insufficient outreach to the group, compared with Trump's more overt efforts. We'll wrap up this week on Religion in the News with an article from Religion News Service dated November 12th, and this article is entitled "Dying the Buddhist Way: Gains in Hospice Centers in the West." The subheadline, "The Emergence of Buddhist-Oriented Hospices in the U.S. and Elsewhere," is said to show a dissatisfaction with conventional Western views of life and death. This article is by Ken Chitwood of Religion News Service, Dateline Berlin. We'll need to edit this somewhat for content to fit in our time restrictions. The man, a local baker, appeared one morning at Sukhvati, a Buddhist center for the dying in the North German spa town of Bad Saarow. His friends said he never talked about being a Buddhist. Oliver Peters, head of spiritual care and volunteering at Sukhvati, said of the unexpected client who died that evening. Only one friend knew his little secret, but his wish was to live and die the Buddhist way. There is no single way of death in a faith that is the dominant religion across Southeast Asia and Japan, and rites vary greatly by region, culture, class, and tradition. But Buddhism puts an emphasis on encountering death that is answering a call in the West for a more spiritual approach to palliative care, hospice service, and chaplaincy programs. In Buddhism, there are a lot of texts and sutras that emphasize death and dying, said Dr. Tuck Wai Chan, a physician in Singapore who has worked to bring Buddhist ideas about the end of life into hospitals. In certain traditions, the whole purpose of Buddhist practice is about death and dying. We know death well. In the past decade and more, a Buddhist end-of-life movement has sprung up in Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, testifying to a need for spiritual accompaniment at the end of life that is felt not only by an aging generation of Buddhist converts and immigrants, but to those who only know that a secular clinical approach is not enough. BuddhaNet's Buddhist Hospice Directory lists about 20 such hospices in predominantly English-speaking countries, as well as Taiwan, Malaysia, and Singapore. There are many more, such as Sukhvati, not listed on the site. At Sukhvati, Peters said the center looks to the teaching of Tibetan Buddhist wisdom, particularly the best-selling Tibetan Book of Living and Dying by Sogyal Rinpoche. In practice, this means the regular chanting of mantras, guided meditations on death, and instructions from Sogyal Rinpoche's book on the passages and obstacles faced in what are known as the bardos, the liminal states between death and rebirth. Finally, the body is attended to for 3 days after death. Requiring special permission from the German health authorities, this time allows the deceased to be honored by family and friends, guided through the bardos, and for those left living to contemplate the separation of the body and mind at death. A belief in Buddhism is not required, Peters said. We don't want to make people Buddhists. Everyone can come here, Muslim, Christian, atheist. We want to help the people to live and to die how they believe and want, he said. It's important for us what someone believes. If someone is a Christian, we find a Christian priest. We try to be open. To that end, Peters and his team have worked with a range of religious leaders to provide spiritual accompaniment for the dying. Recently, Peters sat by a Muslim man's bedside as an imam said prayers and recited verses from the Quran. Peters tells of a client who came to spend his last day at Sukhavati despite never being interested in Buddhism. When Peters asked him why, he simply said, "I'm here that you pray for me." People like this man, said Peters, don't really know where they are, but they like the environment, or they've heard something about the Dalai Lama, or think that Buddhists are quiet and peaceful. Maybe they don't have a good history with Christianity, and they think Buddhists are better with caring for the dying. But in the rising popularity of places like Sukhavati is an implicit critique of conventional Western views of life and death. Frank Ostaseski, Buddhist teacher and co-founder of the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco, said that in a consumerist culture often enchanted by youth, Buddhist hospice care is offering an alternative whose unvarnished view of death also offers a new perspective on living. It also suggests that people are realizing they don't want to end their lives in the company of medical professionals, said Ostaseski, author of The Five Invitations, Discovering What Death Can Teach Us About Living Fully. We don't want to just give this over to medicine anymore. Death is much more than a medical event. Chin-Sing Han, author of Be the Refugee, Raising the Voices of Asian American Buddhists, spent a summer volunteering for the Brahma Vihara AIDS Project in Cambodia, the country with the highest per capita concentrations of Buddhists. After her time in Cambodia, Han not only deepened her own Buddhist practice, but volunteered at the Pathways Hospice in California's Bay Area, then enrolled for formal training as a Buddhist chaplain at the Satis Center for Buddhist Studies in Redwood City, California. Through her experiences, Han said, she learned that the chaplain's role is in many ways countercultural to the biomedical model of care. In the chaplain's view, death is not a failure, but a sacred transition that awaits us all. Well, that's it for our time this week on Religion in the News. We certainly do appreciate you tuning in, and thank you for being a part of the program. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Don't forget that you can listen to previous episodes of Religion in the News broadcasts on our website at ncreadingservice.org. Just click the listen link and then follow the page down to the podcast section. Then select Religion in the News, and you'll be able to select from your choice of previous broadcasts. We certainly appreciate you taking the time to listen to today's program. This is Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.